It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Bye.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hold on.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is a perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
And thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And if you are a member or a user, I should say, of Facebook, you can easily find the Patriot Journalist Network by going to your search engine there at on Facebook and just type in Patriot Journalist Network as one word, and you'll find this show as long as other shows such as Mark Prasik's Full Armor, which you can find weekdays from 8 p.m. until midnight Eastern Time. And thank you all, whether you are listening from Blog Talk Radio or listening through Bard's Logic Political Talk's website, or if you're going to be listening to this live or in the chat, thank you very much again for coming. Now, normally I would play the song all the way through, but we already have our special guest in here tonight, who is the Constitution Party's National Vice Chair, Randy Shufflebeam. And I believe I have his mic open. And thank you very much, Mr. Shufflebeam. How are you tonight?
I am outstanding. In fact, I tell people quite often, if I was any better, there'd be two of me, and as a Marine, that would be trouble because there'd be a fight, and then, you know, things would just go downhill from that point.
Understood. Well, looks like we got a full slot of some questions for this evening, and what I'd like to start off with is if you could just give us a brief overview of your life, background, where you're born, raised, military career, your life after Marines, and your political career, and lastly, why you are dedicated to the Constitution Party since 2004.
Well, that's a whole lot to ask. But I'll keep it short.
We're not very demanding here on Bard's Logic. We just never... Go ahead. Well, how about a synopsis?
I can do synopsis. But you're talking to a guy who can take a 5-minute speech and make an hour out of it. So I'll
that's a good quality to have.
Well, I was born in 1960, and here in Illinois, I was actually born in Chicago, but I did not grow up in Chicago. My parents moved out of Chicago within 2 years. And so I really grew up in the central part of the state in a little town called Canton, Illinois. I describe it as being a little town out in the middle of the cornfield, a little bit bigger than it, being able to throw a rock from one end to the other. You'd probably have to actually use a slingshot or something, but not that great of a big of a community. And then I graduated from high school and shortly went off to college, and college didn't seem to agree with me. And from that point, I joined the Marine Corps, and I joined the Marine Corps in January of 1980 and did a 22-and-a-half-year enlistment there, and spent the last 5 years in Okinawa, Japan. And then when I came back from Okinawa, Japan, I actually had to move in with my parents, something that I never, ever dreamed of or foresaw in my life. You know, here I am actually a grandfather having to move back in with my parents, and didn't have a job for, almost a year after I had retired. And so I had a little extra time on my hands. And one of the things that happened was that in October of 2003, I was surfing the internet, doing a little bit of research, and I came across the issue with Chief Justice Roy Moore, who most people may know as the Ten Commandments judge. He was the Alabama Supreme Court judge who in 2004 was removed from his position as Chief Justice, and it was over the issue of a Ten Commandments monument. But I'll never forget that during the trial and all of that, I say trial, it was more of a kangaroo court than a trial. They were asking the judge, you know, stuff like, well, will you recognize God in your job? And I never forget that the judge says, I must acknowledge God in everything that I do. And while I was watching all of that unfold in 2003, there was a thing that happened. There was the Focus on the Family has an alert process, and they sent out this alert alerting people that there was going to be a rally in support of Chief Justice Roy Moore, that it was going to be held at every state capitol throughout the nation, and that it was sponsored by the Constitution Party. Now, at the same time that this was going on, I actually thought, you know what, I'm going to try to get involved in politics. I'm not able to get a job right now. Maybe that's why a lot of politicians go into politics. I don't know. But anyway, at this time, I had actually gone and I had gotten all the signatures that I needed for the petition for the particular office that I was going to run for. And that's when this whole thing about Chief Justice Roy Moore was unfolding. And when I read what happened was, in the alert, it was saying sponsored by the Constitution Party. Well, as typical, even now, Constitution Party, I never heard of it before. And so I did a link for me to be able to go to the Constitution Party. And I'll tell you, when I read through the platform, I discovered that I had found my new home. And so as a part of this, though, and part of this discovery was I was realizing that this whole thing against Chief Justice Roy Moore was perpetrated not only by the Democrats, but by Republicans. And I was I was incensed by this, to discover that both the Republicans and the Democrats were willing to compromise and actually violate the very first Bill of Rights, the First Amendment that protects not only our freedom of speech, not only our freedom of religion, but the free exercise thereof. And when I realized this, I basically felt like I was a man without a country, or in this particular case, a man without a party, because they were so willing to violate this oath that I had made
Understood.
For 22 years, willing to give my life over to. And so I got, I took my petition that I had all the signatures I needed, and I took it to the Republican chairman, and I told the chairman, I said, look, the Republican Party has completely lost its way. It is violating our Constitution, and I could no longer be a part of this. And I tore up my petition right on his desk, and I said, I am no longer a Republican, but I am now considering myself a constitutionalist. And so at that point, it was I was in contact with the folks who wanted to actually get the Constitution Party started here in Illinois. And so within 3 months, we had our first organizational meeting, and I became the vice chairman of the party. And through a series of events, within a year, I became the chairman of the party. And bear in mind, I never had a political bone in my body before this. I never had any machinations about being governor or president or senator or anything. Never. And so this was an area that I had no experience in whatsoever. But as chairman, we needed to get a gubernatorial candidate to run in 2006. And what was normally, you know, for the two parties, you know, that's not such a big deal. But when you're talking about a quote-unquote third party, it becomes very difficult. And as chairman of the Constitution Party here in the state of Illinois, it was my job and my mission to find somebody to run for the state of for their party here in the state of Illinois for governor. And but after months and months of searching, calling, and talking, and meeting, and you know, with people, the phrase "if not me, then who" started resonating in my brain housing group and just wouldn't go away. And so after about the fourth or fifth month, I realized I'm not going to find the who. And I was desperately trying to fill in that who because I had no idea what I was doing. But one day the realization came, I'm not going to find it. And that with that, if it's not me, then who? Well, I was trying to desperately fill in the who, but guess what? When I looked in the mirror, it became me. And so I went in and I went and talked to my wife. And she was sitting on the couch innocently, minding her own business. And I went in there and I said, honey, I think I'm going to have to run for governor. I think, you know, I'm left with no other choice, but I'm going to have to run for governor. She looked at me, big deer in the headlight kind of look. And after a couple of minutes, she said, well, Randy, if that's what God's called you to, let's rock. And so I ran for governor. I tried to get ballot access, but the onerous ability of trying to get 25,000 signatures, I didn't come close. And so, but at the same time, the Republicans gave Illinois Judy Barr Topinka, and the Democrats gave us Rob Blagojevich, both of whom were pro-homosexual, both of whom were pro-choice, both of whom were pro-gun control, and, you know, the list goes on, you know, willingness to violate the Constitution and everything else. So I realized there's still a battle to fight here. And so I declared my intent to run as a write-in candidate. I have to send a letter to all 110 election jurisdictions. And on November the 6th of 2006, I got officially 19,020 votes, which blew away Ralph Nader's with, and I describe this with people, is I was a nobody from Nowheresville that nobody knew, and I had to teach them how to write a name like Stufflebeam to get it to count on our ballots. So after that, you know, I got more involved and became the regional chairman, which encompasses 12 states here in the Midwestern region. And in 2010, I ran for U.S. Senate as the Constitution Party candidate, and the Republican Party spent probably, and I could take you to the Illinois Board of Elections and go through all the finances and demonstrate that they probably spent somewhere around $250,000 to keep me off the ballot. Earlier this year, I had relinquished the regional chair and ran for chairman of the Constitution Party. I lost that race, but was given the consolation prize of becoming the vice chairman, and now I'm just really out here trying to build the party and get our candidate elected and do all those kind of things.
Well, thank you very much, Randy. Then I'm going to leave the floor here to Chris to start off the questions that we have. And I just want to tell the audience, if we have some time tonight, we may have some folks be able to call in and ask some other questions that, you know, as they like. Is that going to be okay with you there, Randy, or Mr. Shufflebeam? if we have some time afterwards, and if you have a time.
I got nothing but time, brother.
Okay, my friend. Well, go ahead, Chris. Go ahead and start out, and then we'll go from there. Thank you, Chris. You there, Chris? You might be turning his mic off mute.
I'm sorry. I had you on mute.
Yep, that's okay.
That was quite a story. I imagine that there's a lot of conversation behind each one of those points we'll have to get into over the years. My first question is just right off the top. You know, we're in the middle of the presidential campaign. What do you see happening right now in our election process? And, I mean, just kind of a snapshot. What do you think about when you look at Obama, Romney, the third-party candidates, et cetera? Just give us your wisdom.
Your question is really broad, and I'm going to try to narrow it down just a tad in that, you know, what we have in front of us is a two-party duopoly that is controlling the political process. And because of the control that's exerted, and this is another conversation we can have at another time as to who, what, why, and all of that, the control exists, the fact remains that there is a two-party duopoly. And I refer to it as the left wing and the right wing of the same bird flying the wrong direction. And in this particular duopoly, we have control. And, you know, I want people to understand that there is a duopoly, and it's very similar to a monopoly. Everybody knows what a monopoly is. There's one controlling factor that controls price, controls quality, controls the market. And what I try to help people understand is that a duopoly is just like a monopoly, only it's at least twice as bad, because not only is there a control, but there is a facade of competition. So people get this kind of warm, fuzzy feeling that, well, you know, I can get a good product at a good price because there's some competition out there. But what they fail to recognize is that there is a gentleman's agreement as to who gets to win, who gets to change the quality, who gets to raise the price, and so on and so forth. And so there's still this controlling factor out there. And because of this controlling factor out there, that really prevents citizen government, then what we find is we've got all of this corruption. People are looking to try to find out a way to control the corruption or to eliminate corruption. And what they fail to understand is our founding fathers designed a system whereby there was checks and balances to help us eliminate some of that corruption because there was competing branches of government. Well, the same thing holds true in a party situation. They've actually circumvented some of those checks and balances because of having this two-party duopoly system that controls who's elected and all of this. And if people don't think that's true, I just really would question what their motives are, what their ability to understand reality is, and so on and so forth. So what we've got is a two-party duopoly that wants to keep out the third-party competition. And I believe with all my heart, if we want to see corruption cut back, if we want to see the country restored to its constitutional boundaries, we're going to have a system of true competition. And in my opinion, that means a multi-party system. I'm not here to destroy the Republican Party. I'm not here to destroy the Democrat Party. I am here to destroy the two-party duopoly and provide competition in the political arena so that we can finally get back to getting a good product at a good price.
That's beautiful. I'm good with that, Robert. Go for it. Thanks, Randy. That was awesome.
Okay, Robert. Great. Thank you. I'm here. And I just didn't want any possible background noise to interrupt his answer, so I, too, have been putting myself on mute. See, for those out there who say that by muting I'm being a fascist, I even muted myself. So what does that tell you? No, but anyway, I digress. I'm just throwing a little humor in there. But up until now, here's the question, and we'll just roll on. Up till now, Romney was losing by approximately 100 electors. Okay, what do you think the debate did for him, and can he hold on to any of the gains he might have made?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter for anybody who has paid attention to anything, there was absolutely nothing new in the debate. How it affected the electors, I'm not really sure how that's going to truly affect the electors because, you know, certainly if Americans are waiting to see these debates to decide who their choice is, and their choice is going to reflect who, quote-unquote, won the debate, then there's certainly some issues, and I don't know what the experts would say are the ability to truly affect that. But I think if there was anything, because there was a lot of people who said, you know, what happened to Obama? You know, that they said that they pointed back to 4 years ago, they pointed back to a couple of years ago, where he seemed to be far more engaged. And quite frankly, it would be my opinion, if the two-party duopoly was afraid of the, you know, Gary Johnson, Virgil Goode, Jill Stein, and Rocky Anderson as taking enough votes away from either of those candidates to where it could actually affect the change, then I think what they're doing is they're designing these debates because people have to understand, and I know that, Chris, I think you put out a link to YouTube video where it describes the contract that the two major party candidates made about what they would discuss, what they wouldn't discuss, so on and so forth. And you've got to realize there is a process at work. This is all not just willy-nilly and off the cuff. This is well-planned, well-thought-out, mechanized machinery that's in place to keep the control of Americans.
I totally agree. Can I add one thing before we roll to the next question that adds to this, Robert? Just say yes. Anyway, you know, you see at the top of the header on my Facebook.
Go ahead, Chris. Sorry about that.
It has that. That's okay.
It's taking me a moment to press to mute. Go ahead.
That's fine. We're good. But at the top of my header on my Facebook page is that screenshot of the CNN that shows that after the debate, who would you likely vote for? 47% said neither, depending on which coast of the America you live on. And that right there tells you something. You know,
though, what people are trying to do now is say that neither really represented undecided. And I'm like, no, it does not represent. It's not like they don't have a clue. It's that they will not choose either of these candidates. That's not undecided. That's actually a pretty smart decision, in my opinion.
Very good. I agree. I agree. I do agree with you, Randy. I think people are just disgusted. Cool. So let's roll to. Sorry, I was looking.
May just real quick to give more weight to what I'm talking about. I believe the same thing happened, only they used Ross Perot to accomplish the task when he ran in, what was it, 1992. And, you know, we see that Ross Perot was actually winning in the polls. And I believe if he would have stayed the course and done everything, Ross Perot would have become a president. But the thing is, and I believe this with all my heart, there was actually a thing in there where Ross Perot was sent in there to splinter the vote when he when things were starting to look like he was going to win. That wasn't the intent. He wasn't intending on winning. So he backed out of the race for nearly a month, and then when, you know, he comes back, he's only able to get 20% of the vote or whatever it was. And, you know, I believe that that's what we've got kind of in a situation with the debates. They don't want to – they fear a third party now. So, you know, they don't want to risk that, so they're trying to do it and control it through the debate system to try to equalize that to keep third parties from actually having an effect and keep that fear-mongering high.
Right. Yeah, I tend to agree with that. Cool. Okay, and we will – more of what we talk about as we roll through, we'll get – you know, we'll open this up some more. Next question. You've been around long enough in the political game to see the rise and what I call the fall of the Tea Party. So what happened to the Tea Parties and the conservatives, and why did they fail in this primary? In other words, how do we end up with Romney? Why is it that if the majority of Republicans are conservatives and Christians, did we end up with Romney?
Well, I think the answer is very, very quick and simple. It's because that the Tea Parties have failed because it was hijacked by the same leadership that is causing the Republican Party to fail. I think it doesn't need much more of an explanation than that. But, you know, why did it allow Romney? Well, you know, I don't think anybody, quote unquote, allowed Romney. I think as you and your cohorts saw down there in Florida, you know, nobody gave it up. They took it, and they used illegal sorts and corrupt methods to accomplish this. Now, what's interesting is I've been out here yelling and screaming to Republicans, especially those who were supporting Ron Paul, because I saw the same thing happened in 2008. And what I was telling people, look, do you really think that they are going to, you know, just, oh, throw their hands up, oh, there's the Tea Party, and they've got so much overwhelming? I said, no, they learned their lessons in 2008, and they're only going to get better. And by God, what happened? They got better, or if you want to say they got worse. In other words, they, you know, the things that they used were far more worse. And what's funny about that is it happened just after a couple of months of the same thing happening here in Illinois. And how these people, you know, I ask people, how much more evidence that there is absolute corruption and control do you need to be punched in the face with before you will say enough is enough? Did I lose everybody now?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I'm waiting for Robert. I just texted him. He's next.
I mean, I can go all of my diatribe, brother.
No, maybe he broke his phone. If he broke his phone, I'll just ask the next question.
No, I'm here. I'm not used to muting myself. And
well, don't mute yourself then.
Well, because of some technical stuff. But anyway, I am here, and I've been here. I just did not want to interrupt, and plus, I keep putting that mute button, but I think I'll just figure something else out. But, yeah, moving on. Can Goode, Johnson, Stein, et cetera, third parties, or I call them grassroots parties, you know, things of that nature, we the people parties, can either one of them or all of them together block both Romney and Obama from getting 270 electors and force this to a brokered convention in the House of Representatives?
Well, you know, when you take a look at the fact that Johnson is on enough ballots to win the presidency, and I think he's just shy somewhere around 250, 260 electors total right at this point. I think he's trying for Pennsylvania and some others yet. When you look at the fact that Virgil Goode is on enough ballots and write-in states to win the presidency, I'm not sure what Stein and Anderson is, but it really doesn't matter. With those two alone, there's enough ability. Well, the problem is, you know, if it was under a constitutional nature of the Electoral College, I'd say, yeah, there might be. But when you look at the fact that most states, with the exception of two, it's a winner-take-all, then I think it's a little bit more problematic to be able to do that. And even if it was, my question would be, to what end? What difference would it make? Because even, and I think it would be pretty cool, because as I think I understand history, it's never been done before. And
one time.
If, what's that?
I think one time. But go ahead.
That may be true, and I'm not sure which one it was. But here's the thing. What difference would it make? The Republicans and the Democrats control the House. Now, there might be more of a chance of Romney getting elected out of the House, since it's a Republican-controlled House right now. And if they retain control, then it's more likely that they would select the Republican, because then it would really look like there's a two-party duopoly if it was intended to be Obama from the start and then the Republicans elected Obama. That would really be interesting.
Let me throw a little sidewinder in that. Just,
sure.
You know, as a perspective. As hard as Romney has had to fight to get recognition or trust by the Republicans, and as much spent money as he has had to spend to get there, even if it ended up in the House and it went to a battle, because the top three guys get in there. So let's say it was Good, you know, Obama and Romney, or Johnson, Obama and Romney. That battle, in my eyes, is just like the brokered convention. They did not want a brokered convention, even if Romney won out of that convention. They did not want Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul on that floor, because it would show how weak Romney really is. And that's something, I think, one of the reasons that they fought so hard to get rid of the delegates, and also to suppress any conversation or challenge from the floor. I actually have videos showing the Paul delegates having enough people, and he actually lent one of his states to Newt, so both of them could be nominated from the floor, you know, five-state plurality. And Priebus said, no, we never got that paperwork. So they do not want to show his weakness. And so
right,
let's say...
I would suggest, though, that the difference is that the difference is between citizens being the delegates, and these are, for the most part, incumbents who have been entrenched into the system and are part
right.
of the controlling factor. And I think that's a major definitive difference here, though.
But do you think if something like this happened, it would be a good thing in terms of public awareness?
In terms of public awareness, maybe it would certainly cause a pretty historic situation that would be covered pretty widely, and it might be the fact that it could expose some of the system for what it is. And so I don't say it's a totally terrible thing. I just don't think that the results are any different than if it doesn't.
Right, right. And that's the way I viewed it. I don't know what the outcome would be. A lot of corruption in that house. But at the same time, if it did happen, I'd be one of the first people cheering it on and buying tickets to watch the fight, the floor fight, and to be there to educate people on why it happened, you know, coming out of the you know, the back end of it, so to speak. Cool. No, I'm good. I'm good with that answer. My next one. Ready?
Bring it on, brother.
All right. So, question, how is Mr. Good doing in the election process, and what would his pathway be to success? And then when you get through with that, just talking about that, give us some education on the importance of ballot access and what a 5% or more in certain states, especially blue states where, you know, Obama's going to win anyway. Like, you know, I live in Washington State. If I helped him get, you know, 5% of the ballot, that what that would do for the future of the party.
Right. Well, Washington is in a deal of its own because it's got the top two, and that's another discussion for another day. How good is Good doing in the election process? You know, I'll be honest, I don't know what his numbers are across the nation. I do know that he is making a significant impact. And what's real interesting, while Gary Johnson has probably a couple of more states that he's actually on the ballot
right.
on than what Virgil Good is, the fact of the matter is that Virgil has had some pretty significant national attention, specifically because of what's been happening in Virginia. And because Virginia is what a lot of people would say, well, here's a pretty big swing state because of how close Romney and Obama are. Based upon the numbers, Virgil is going to significantly impact the electoral process there in Virginia. In fact, the Republican Party primarily has been so afraid of this that they have even tried to they've even submitted a lawsuit, as I understand it, against the Secretary of State for accepting Virgil Good's petitions. And you got to understand, Virgil delivered 20,000 signatures for a requirement of 10,000 signatures. And they were trying to, like they always do, say, you know, these signatures were gotten fraudulently and all of this. So, you know, I think he's doing pretty well as a
quote-unquote third-party candidate in the process. And you ask what the pathway is to success, and I think, you know, really getting it, the pathway to success here is we've got to really start pounding away at the fear-mongering that the Republican and the Democrats are doing. You know, you've got to vote for Romney to keep Obama. You got to vote for Obama to keep Romney from winning. And, you know, they're doing, if nothing else, the Republican Party is doing exceptionally well at the fear-mongering. I'm seeing no discussion out there as people are saying, oh, Romney is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and, you know, he's a breath of fresh air. You know, all we're hearing is, you know, he's not the best, but we got to keep Obama out. And, you know, for the most part, we're hearing much the same thing for Obama. So the big thing, that the pathway to success here is really to attack this fear-mongering and help people understand it is the fear-mongering that consistently puts this country into jeopardy. I mean, as a third-party person, I was here for the first time in the 2004 elections. We heard exactly the same thing. Oh, you got to vote for Bush to keep the evil man John Kerry from winning, and blah, 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 blah. And then the same thing, you know, in 2008. So we've got to trump this fear-mongering. Now, the second part is you've asked what is the importance of gaining 5%. Now, here's where the real, in my opinion right now, the real battle lies, and that is in establishing the Constitution Party as an established party throughout this nation. And the difference is, and I'll explain that here in just a second, but before I get to that, the idea, like for instance in Minnesota, it's pretty much a given Obama is going to walk away with Minnesota. And in this case, a vote for Romney is an absolute waste of a vote and an absolute waste of time. Obama's taking it. You can vote till you're blue in the face. Obama's taking Minnesota, and it's true for other states like Ohio and others.
Washington.
But here's where the key is. If they would not vote for Romney and waste their vote, but cast their vote for Virgil, well, here is a case, or, you know, in third parties, you know, if Virgil's not your guy, I'm okay if you vote for Gary Johnson. But the point is, get additional parties established. All Virgil needs is 5% of the vote, and then the Constitution Party becomes an established party in the state. Now, let me give you an instance as to why it's so important, and for instance, specifically related here to Illinois, because the Green Party became an established party for 4 years statewide from 2006 to 2010. Rich Whitney got 16% of the vote as a protest vote in the governor's race because nobody could stand the Blagojevich and Judy Bart Topinka. So they became an established party. Now, here's the difference. In the gubernatorial race, or even in the presidential race, we have to, as a third party, have to deliver 25,000 signatures within 90 days. The Republicans and Democrats only need to deliver 5,000 signatures. In the race for the 12th district in 2010, we were running a U.S. Congressional candidate, and we had to get 15,000 signatures, where the Republicans and Democrats only needed to deliver, I believe it was 500, maybe 1,000, but I don't think it was 1,000. I think it was only 500. But here's where the real key is. We had to deliver 15,000, and let's just say the Republicans had to deliver and the Democrats had to deliver 1,000. Because the Green Party was an established party, and they didn't get a whole lot of votes in that particular district, you'll never guess how many signatures they needed. It was 47. That's 47.
Wow. Well, ridiculous.
15,000 signatures. So ballot access, really, in our fight is absolutely crucial, and it's pretty much the same is played. While the numbers are a little different, the same principle is true throughout this nation. And so ballot access is crucial not only for signature gathering, but it's also crucial for being able to have primaries. Here in Illinois, unless you're an established party, you're not able to run a primary. And in many states, there are people that can actually register as constitutionalists because they have ballot access. People can go poll a constitutional primary ticket and be able to vote for a constitutional candidate. Now, here in Illinois, we actually have a county that's established, and so they held a primary. And so it's, we're looking at really establishing this party, and that's where the presidential race becomes crucial, because if you get it established at the state level, then the rest of the state benefits from it, and the rest of the state can run candidates from dog catcher to president from now on and provide a constant and consistent stream of constitutional candidates.
So really, and then I'll just close this up and hand it to Robert because for the next question to keep it rolling. So basically, the RNC is not trying to so much keep Goode from actually winning. They're just trying to keep the Constitution Party from becoming established.
Yes. It's not a personal attack on Goode and all of that. They do not want a third party. And like I said, I believe in a multi-party system where as much as I am diametrically opposed to the Green Party, I believe they have an important role to play as another party in the system. And I believe once we start having parties, we have competition throughout the system.
Right. Cool. And we'll get into that more as we get down into strategy. Robert, you're up, buddy.
Great. Thank you. And thank you very much for the answer.
You're welcome very much.
All righty. Now, let's say what would electing someone like Virgil Goode and Jim Clymer mean to this country? And what changes would a Goode administration make? So let's say he wins the presidency. What would a Goode administration look like?
Well, it would be, quite frankly, a very difficult thing because, you know, as we saw with Jesse Ventura, when he was elected to the gubernatorial, you know, as governor of, what was it, Minnesota?
Yes.
Whichever M state it was.
Minnesota, I believe.
Yeah, that's what I think it was. Well, you know, when he first started out, things were, people had no idea what to do with it. But eventually, basically, you know, he became a lame duck governor because the Republicans and Democrats finally got their stuff together to actually unite together to overturn and overrule what Ventura was doing. So, you know, I would expect that if a third-party candidate or a independent of any sort would be able to be elected as president, it would probably about amount to the same thing. Now, what would happen, though, I believe it would be good for the country because initially, you know, Goode and I, to some degree, Johnson, I believe would look to the Constitution and use veto power to kill a lot of bills that would otherwise, you know, have gotten through. And, you know, if there is truly a problem within the – I'm telling you, you know, a blockade keeping our government from doing – we can't afford our government to continue to do anything more. And just to just time it and kill it for the most part for a while might actually be a good thing for Americans. But, you know, one of the good things that could happen, though, is they don't have to have permission from Congress to eliminate the unconstitutional executive orders. And both Clymer and Goode, I believe, have both, you know, given strong indications that if they were elected as president and a presidential team, that they would, the first act is to eliminate, to rescind all of those unconstitutional executive orders. Now, the other thing that would be of a tremendous benefit, one of the things that we face as third-party people is we constantly hear over and over, you can never win. You can't win. This is a two-party system. You don't have a chance to win. Unless you have billions of dollars, you don't have a chance to win. Well, you know, if a presidential candidate is asked to win, that would decimate that particular issue.
Right. Okay. Cool. Robert, you got the next one, and then we're going to kick into some crazy stuff.
Okay, great. And I like crazy stuff. Okay, so we've got a list here. But first, though, now we have – I'm looking in on this, so I apologize for that. We have already interviewed, as you probably well know, Mr. Goode and Mr. Clymer and several House and Senate candidates from your party, and discussed some policies at length. And I'm going to interject something here real quick, just something that I'm working on and I'm hoping can pan out, is I've got the questions from the presidential debate, or at least what should have been the questions. What I did is I kind of extrapolated by what they said, asking the questions during the debate between Obama and Romney. And while they really weren't questions per se, you could actually get some questions, themes and questions out of them. And what I'd like to do is have Mr. Goode on as an opportunity to answer these questions, so his answers can be heard on how he would have answered these debate questions, since neither the Republicans or the Democrats had the, what in my opinion, the courage to have him, as well as maybe Johnson or Stein, on to answer these questions. So I think that'd be great. But anyway, that being said, what we'd like you to do is, if you could recap the Constitution Party's policies for our listeners, and for our Dr. Paul listeners, how close is Mr. Goode to Dr. Paul on policies? And first, I'd like to start off with the economy.
Well, just roll right down through it. I'm sorry, Robert, the way I wrote
just
that, my mistake.
Okay,
yeah, just
no, no problem.
Do a recap. Just
well,
a,
okay,
a
well, well, yeah, give him the list.
Yeah.
Sure, I'll give him the list. The answer is the economy, immigration, and the crime that goes with it, the Fed, cutting the budget, taxes, paying down the debt, entitlement program, foreign aid, foreign policy and wars, the Middle East, and I have some particular direct questions on those, terrorism, the NDAA. See, that's why this is a huge list for, you know, to try and remember all those, but fusion centers, internment camps, et cetera.
Policy.
That's why I was going to get one down. That's why I was going to think about doing it separately. But go ahead, Randy. Thank you.
Well, let me first start off by saying the only official position of the party can be found in our platform. And anybody who wants to know what's in our platform can go to constitutionparty.com and pull it up and be able to, I mean, we've got a platform that takes almost, if you print it out, depending on the size font that you use, somewhere between 20 and 22 pages. So it is pretty encompassing. And not only does the platform give positions, but it also gives justifications for those positions to help people understand why the Constitution Party comes up with the position that it does. So I want to say that regardless of what I say or that you hear anybody else say about the party, our official position is contained within the platform of the party. Now, having said that, I'll address real quickly, kind of I'll answer the for the, you know, how Goode and Ron Paul diverge a little bit on the issues is that, as you know, even in spite of the fact that Ron Paul was a Republican for a significant number of years, most people reflect that Ron Paul was a little bit more libertarian in his views than Republican. And I think that would be also a pretty true statement between what Ron Paul and Virgil Goode would be. But in fact, I know that Virgil and Ron Paul even worked together. They were on the same committee. There was some mutual support there. So there was very similar things about their policies. Now, one of the things that normally comes out when people look is that Virgil Goode, when the Patriot Act first came out, he actually voted for it. And in multiple times, in multiple venues, Virgil has repeatedly apologized for that. He admits that it was somewhat of a knee-jerk reaction. And but we've held, pretty much tried to hold Virgil accountable to a couple of those things like that. And so that, in terms of what might have been divergent between Ron Paul and Mr. Goode, that would have been initially one of those things. And I believe that they might be a little, not drastically, a little divergent on the issue of legalizing drugs. the Constitution Party is not necessarily for, now, while we, you know, uphold individual liberty, we also uphold the rule of law, and we're not really strong on legalizing pot and other illicit forms of drugs. And so that might be another place where they might be a little bit more divergent. But again, Virgil has actually spoken on these things, and, you know, you must take what Virgil has said on this. And so here's the deal. You know, when you're talking about, you know, all these, this list of stuff, you know, the economy. Well, one of the things, and I think this is really, I really want to make this as absolutely clear as possible, because we hear so much rhetoric in the media. We hear rhetoric by, you know, all the talking heads, and we hear the rhetoric being espoused from both of the major party candidates about how they are going to affect the economy, how they are going to affect jobs, and how they are going to cut, increase taxes. Well, the fact of the matter is, they cannot raise or lower taxes. Congress has the responsibility. Now, certainly, they can sign or veto bills regarding any form of bill that comes. But the fact of the matter is, the real source of power when it comes to the economy resides with Congress, not the president. It is Congress that regulates trade and tariffs. It is Congress that regulates the taxes and all of this. That if you look at Article 1, Section 8, the very first clause says the power of taxation is Congress, not the president. And so when we're talking about the effects of the economy, while certainly the president could be viewed as the head and the leader in all of this, the fact of the matter is, if Congress didn't want to raise taxes, they don't send a bill up there to raise taxes. If they want to lower it, they send a bill to lower it. And then if the president vetoes it, they do have the power to overcome that veto. The power lies with Congress. Now, in terms of immigration and the crime that goes with it, the party is against the invasion of the illegal alien. And Virgil Goode's, I know, position is this, and I like it a lot because it kind of deals with the job situation too. He would want to see a moratorium imposed on immigration across the board until unemployment reached below the 5%.
And let me say this, Randy, is actually just personally, that's probably one of my favorite things that I've heard coming about him, you know, policy-wise when it comes to immigration. I must say I really like that idea.
I was floored when I first heard it. I'm like, you know, that was brilliant, you know, because then that puts into perspective several different things, the illegal immigration, the job situation, the circumstances of the economy that we are faced, and how, you know, illegal aliens tremendously affect that. And notice I'm not calling it illegal immigrants, because either you're an immigrant or you're an illegal alien. And so, you know, I really make that distinction between the two. So, and Virgil Goode and this party stand strongly against an illegal invasion of this country and, of course, you know, the crime that is associated with it. When you talk about the Fed, it's pretty, you know, in the Fed. Of course, they want to see an audit of the Fed. In my opinion, a lot of people disagree, and that's okay. My opinion is an audit really is not going to be all that effective. People say, well, when Americans start to see what's really out there, then, you know, they'll want to make a change. I'm like, look, they can already see the garbage that's going on, and what kind of a change are they making now? So I may be a little bit pessimistic about this, but
real quick, Randy. One thing I want to move up just a second and just make a comment about the immigration. It's one of the things that I've read about the Constitution Party as well. That once again, I must honestly say, I personally like is that they're talking about no automatic citizenship for children who are born. Some people were calling me callous today when I was talking to them about it. But they're talking about no automatic citizenship for children born of illegal aliens.
Right, anchor babies. Yeah, we're strongly opposed to anchor babies. I mean, you know, the fact that you were born here doesn't make by illegal aliens does not make you a citizen of these United States. And that's why our founding fathers really, you know, talked about being a natural born citizen, which we're not going to go down that road right now. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We are strongly opposed to anything that comes out of an illegal situation.
Right.
Right.
Let's talk common sense. You know what I mean? That's my comment on that one. Go ahead. I don't want to stop you. You're on a roll.
Well, we can talk about defending. Of course, that's one of Ron Paul's strongest positions. And, to end the Fed, and I certainly appreciate, you know, all that he has done in that, you know, in bringing that to America's attention. But if people only understood how vile and evil the Federal Reserve, which incidentally is neither federal nor does it have a reserve, really is.
That was a great statement.
Then, of course, talking about cutting the budget. Now, this was, you know, first of all, this was probably one of the most atrocious, horrendous items of debate between the two major candidates for presidency is cutting the budget. You know, when you and I get strapped for cash or we are really indebted because of some stupid, idiotic ways of going out and getting credit, what happens is, you know, we have to tighten up the belt. And, you know, instead of getting steak every night, we drop down to hot dogs and ramen noodles. You know, we start trimming the budget. In fact, you know, we start cutting things out of the budget, like going to restaurants. We cut out going to movies. We cut out going to the races and going here and going there. Because, you know, at the end of the day, we cannot spend more than we have. And, citizens get arrested when they start doing that. And, you know, for the fact of the matter that these two candidates at the debates never once talked about what they're going to really start cutting back. And, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, the party and Virgil Goode is all about is eliminating the unconstitutional departments that we find in our government, such as the Department of Education. You know, there's not really federally, not one thing that has benefited these United States with the Department of Education. If anything, it's only made it worse. And the idea that, you know, they're going to raise more money, and their only reason to get more jobs, if you heard what they were saying, the only reason to get more jobs is to get more people investing in the taxing situation so we can actually generate more revenue. Their idea is to generate more revenue, to keep in place these unconstitutional departments of government, the unconstitutional nature of our military being spread across the globe, and all of these. So we want to cut back, you know, and make this country constitutional once again. The next item kind of flows into this, and actually, you know, the idea of paying down the debt, all of this is kind of all part of the idea, but you know, the Constitution Party, interestingly, was originally, when it was first created in 1992, it was created as the U.S. Taxpayers Party. And their one main objective was to eliminate the what we consider the unconstitutional amendment, the 16th and the 17th Amendment, but primarily their focus was on the 16th Amendment, which allowed Congress to start taxing our income. Prior to 1913, there was no such thing as an income tax. And when people say, well, you know, given what our government is doing, how could we possibly fund our government with that kind of a taxation system? Well, that's just the point. We should not be. And so the party would like to see an end to the 16th Amendment. We would repeal that in a heartbeat. We'd also repeal the 17th Amendment, which is associated with that. And, of course, all of that happening in 1913 as the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913. And when you put these pieces of the puzzle together, see how nicely they fit together, you start getting a picture of evil that was perpetrated on the people of the United States, these United States. And so, you know, the fact is we start cutting down all these unconstitutional entities of the government, all the unconstitutional spending, pull our troops back from all the globe hopping that we do, and we could actually start paying down our debt. Entitlement programs.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to go ahead, Randy. I'll come back.
Oh, well, if you've got a question, I'm just trying to keep flowing here.
No, you're good. Go ahead.
Well, you know, one of the ideas about the entitlement programs is, according to the federal constitution, if it's not in the Constitution, it's left for the states. There is nothing in the Constitution that would give indication that there should be any form of welfare entitlements. Now, people will say, well, wait a minute, there's the welfare clause. Well, here's the interesting thing about it is, while I will say there is a welfare clause, the thing of it is, the welfare clause was a broad statement that was more narrowly defined in the rest of Article 1, Section 8. And that is what provides for the welfare of these United States. Defense, postal roads, and that sort of thing, as constitutionally delineated in Article 1, Section 8. Everything else, look, if the states want to do it, then, you know, then the states are okay to do that. But I would still suggest that it's not even a good idea to, you know, for our government to have the ability to redistribute wealth based on some form of understanding of what welfare and all of the entitlements are, because as we know, the government is corrupt. The government will use these funds in corrupt ways. And so, you know, leave it in the hands of the church as it was originally done back in the day, in 1913, before all of this unconstitutional taxation took place, and now all of a sudden the government can fund all of this stuff.
Beautiful.
Foreign aid.
On a roll.
Foreign aid, you know, that we have to be careful about what we're defining as foreign aid. You know, just delivering billions of dollars out to all of these various countries for various and sundry reasons, it is killing us. We are funding our enemies as well as what should be our associates and allies. And for people not to understand that is just beyond bizarre to me, that they don't understand. You know, people say, well, we've got to support Israel. We've got to support Israel. Well, you know, our position in the Constitution Party is just eliminate all foreign aid. And I'll tell you what, if we were to just eliminate all foreign aid across the board, Israel would be a whole lot better off.
And Randy, I'm going to interject here for a moment, and because I'm going to interject this question here, because I said I told somebody I would ask the question, and they phrase it here in this way. They phrase it, says, President Obama has drawn, and it's directly to what you just said about the unilateral withdrawal of foreign aid. And they asked, since President Obama has drawn us deeper into the Middle East and North Africa than we were under Bush, given that dynamic, how can we unilaterally withdraw all foreign aid?
Well, here's the problem. Could we do it tomorrow? No. Because what has happened is, we, the people, have allowed our government to take us into foreign entanglements that we should never have been. I mean, we invaded a country, a sovereign nation with their own form of government without a declaration of war. We're traipsing around, propping up this particular political figure and trying to take down this political figure. We have our fingers in so many different places that if we just all of a sudden tomorrow pull everything in, you're right, chaos would ensue. But we have to immediately draw up plans. And I'll tell you something, give a calendar date. Because then it would put the world on notice that we have every intention of upholding our Constitution. Constitution and pulling our money back, pulling our troops, and start defending our own borders. It would put the world on notice. And if they want to say, well, that would give impetus to the terrorists, well, what? Guess what? It would also give impetus to the people of that country to say, you know what? You need to start taking some responsibility for yourselves rather than solely relying on us to be the people who is giving our blood, our men, our women for your preservation. It's time to start taking a look at Americans instead of all the rest of these people across the world. So, yeah, you know, doing it tomorrow, not feasible, not wise whatsoever. But to do so in a phased approach and say we are doing it and we will do it, you know, so on and so forth, we need to do it as soon as possible. There are some places that we could immediately pull out and nobody would ever notice that we were gone. So, you know, in those places, yeah, we could do that tomorrow. But there are some foreign entanglements, such as, you know, the things that are going on in Libya and all these other places, that we would have to, you know, create a phased approach to doing it, but a dedication to restoring our constitutional presence in this world.
Boy, that sounds like a breath of fresh air.
I appreciate you answering that question as well. So this is someone who was on earlier wanted to, or asked me in chat to ask that. I figured since we were at that point in the conversation,
hey, Robert,
then we could go ahead and
then. Robert,
sure.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Read me the first part of that sentence. Immediate interjection, and I forgot what it was. Can you read me first part again?
Of the person's question?
Yes.
I would try to do it by memory because it was in a chat, and I took out the chat. It said, and I'm paraphrasing, is because Obama has gotten us deeper.
I got it. Never mind. Okay, first of all, Obama didn't get us deeper into something necessarily because he necessarily wanted to. Bush set us up in these situations, and if you really want the truth, you can go back for decades and decades and decades and decades. We have been entangled in this mess for a long time. When President Bush decided to attack a sovereign nation and start this whole cycle going, there's so many things behind the scenes of Randy, with 22 and a half years in the Marine Corps, could probably give us some insights to this stuff. But, you know, we can point fingers at Obama all day long, but this cycle in the Middle East has been going on a long time before Obama got here. I just wanted to make that interjection.
You want to comment on that? You're absolutely right. In fact, I've said this many times. Most of what Obama has been able to accomplish, he would never have been able to accomplish it had it not been for his predecessor to set it up. I mean, you know, we forget that it was Bush that started out the stimulus packages and all of this, so and the bailout. So, you know, to try to put all this onus on Obama is ludicrous, which gives, you know, more substantial weight to the fact that I call it a two-party duopoly.
Yeah, I think both of them. This stuff's been going on for. I mean, we can go all the way back. You know, even with the formation of Israel, when people are so, you know, we've got to defend Israel, we've got to fund Israel, we've got to do this for Israel. If you really look at Israel and their whole history, every time Israel got attacked by an enemy and they started kicking butt and taking names and expanding their territory so they could have a better protection zone, we forced them to pull back. So are we really helping them? Are we really their best friend and their best ally? We fund their enemies and we fund them, and everybody's always screaming, we got to take care of Israel, we got to take Israel, but they don't forget we're also taking care of their enemies at the same time. This mess is so intertangled that there's got to be a point where we just step back, take a breath of fresh air, and recalculate our whole foreign policy. And it is not going to be done by the Democrats, and is not going to be done by the Republicans. You watch. If Romney wins and the Republicans maintain the House and win or not win the Senate, nothing will change. We will be in a war in 2 or 3 years. This has been planned for a long time. Am I crazy, Randy?
Crazy like a fox, baby.
Can I answer that question as to whether Chris is crazy
No, he's kidding.
Well, you know, I was crazy for joining the Marine Corps. So, you know, I have a history of crazy.
Well, I've spent, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, you know, my mother's a history sociology major. And so as a very young child, and if you understand the difference between just being a history teacher and a history sociology major, is that she sees beyond the data of history and dates and events. She's the kind of person that would pull all the components, sociology, religion, wars, economics, things that were occurring in the world, migrations of people. And so at a very young age, I'm not smart, I just had some really smart parents. At a very young age, my mom was explaining how to look past the data and look at all the components involved and then come to a conclusion based on real facts, not just the facts of the day. And that's what I find so much when I hear people talking about the issues in foreign policy is, oh, this guy was shot at this embassy. Well, first of all, there was no embassy there. And second of all, what was he doing there in the first place? Third of all, what was he doing there with unarmed military guarding him in a place where we already knew we had enemies on a celebration day of 9/11? I mean, come on, you've got to think past what the news feeds you to get you all riled up. I believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that what they're doing is they're gearing up America for a war. Am I wrong? Am I crazy, guys?
What do you mean, gearing them up? We're already in wars.
Getting all the natives riled up. So when they launch a war in the Middle East, we're all for it, screaming to our congressmen, sending emails going, get them.
Right.
That's what I mean.
Well, here's the other thing, too. You know, Chris, and you bring up the point, you know, when we're talking about foreign policy, when we're talking about foreign entanglements, you know, what most people have absolutely no clue about. You know, yeah, we toppled an evil dictator. Saddam Hussein needed to go down. He was killing his own people. But guess what? The United States put him there.
Yeah.
You know, it was the people that provided him arms and training and all kinds of support to get him to be the leader of Iraq. We put him there. In 1978, he received the keys to the city of Detroit. We knew who Obama was. We knew he was evil. That's why we put him there, because he wasn't afraid to take out the opposition. And yet people have no clue what the level of foreign involvement. Here's another one to consider. Remember when 9/11 happened? What was the mantra? We are going to attack. We're going out for any country who harbored these terrorists. And what's interesting is, we go to Iraq and fight Iraq in the midst of all of this, but where do we launch all of our attacks from? The very country where most of the terrorists came from, Saudi Arabia. They're our friends. They're the ones who harbored the terrorists. There was no terrorist camps throughout Saudi Arabia, but yet we go in there and buddy-buddy with Saudi Arabia to go attack Iraq. The insanity of it, if people just understood and knew what our federal government was doing with their foreign aid and their foreign policy, it would blow your mind.
You know, Newt said in an interview one time, Newt said, we're looking at all the wrong enemies and all the wrong friends. He said, we need to be paying attention to Saudi Arabia, and we need to be paying attention to Pakistan. He said, we're totally in the wrong, have the total wrong view of what we consider enemies and friends, and especially Saudi Arabia. I had friends who used to work in Saudi. People don't have a clue, you know, what we're supporting there.
Well, here's another one. You know, we talk about the NDAA. Well, there's a section within the NDAA, and for people who might not be astute as to what that is the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 that authorizes funding of military forces, and while there are certainly some parts about that is necessary and constitutional, you know, in the funding of our military, There are certainly parts of it that are unconstitutional. But here's one of the interesting sections of it, is there's actually contained within the NDAA a section regarding the war on drugs. Okay, so here we've got a document that is funding the war on drugs, and it is funding our military. So put those two together. You would think that wherever our military is going, we would be making sure that, you know, there's no, you know, significant drug traffic and all of that, because it's all financed in the same authorization act. Well, here's an interesting statistic. Prior to our invasion of Afghanistan, Afghanistan was only providing about somewhere between 7 and 8% of all the heroin that came into the United States. Since the occupation of American forces in Afghanistan, that number has gone up to about 85% now.
Oh, my God. Sounds like Vietnam all over again, doesn't it, Randy?
Man, I'm telling you, if people only would take the time to look at these important details, they would start getting a picture of what our federal government is doing to us as American citizens, and they want to know why I'm hacked off.
Are you hacked off? You sound calm to me.
You haven't seen me get hacked off yet, brother, let me tell you.
Oh, Robert, let's see, where are we at?
That's passion, guys.
That was beautiful. I knew. I'm glad that you had a copy of these so we could fly through these Q&A. That
well,
was awesome.
Well, I have fusion centers here about to talk about, but I think my take on fusion centers are a little different than the fusion centers that you're probably talking about here, Chris. The fusion centers I would like to see are actually fusion centers as in fusion energy, as in using the helium-3, but that's going off on a tangent, little digression. I'd like to see fusion centers, and I'm talking about fusion nuclear power plant, instead of the fission nuclear power plants, because fusion power is a clean energy, which, Chris, you are well aware that I am a big of supporter of, but that will be something for another day. But we will discuss the fusion centers that you're talking about, Chris, so that's what's next.
Well, that's part of that whole last question, which he's already kind of started on, you know, the whole NDAA.
Yeah, we can elaborate,
like,
sure.
Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about the things that we've heard on the internment camps, the fusion centers, all that stuff, Randy.
Yeah, and, you know, when you start talking about internment camps and these kind of things, people are like, oh, here we go. You're a conspiracy theorist. And let me tell you.
I have my tin hat on.
Yeah, well, my most favorite line of a movie of all time is, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
Yep.
And, you know, people need to take a look at what is truly happening around. I mean, you know, when they were talking about the North American Union and how they were going to have this road from Mexico and a port created in Kansas City, Missouri, we actually stopped by where that port was actually being set up. I mean, we saw it with our own two eyes. And
actually, if I may interject here, for the folks who watched the debate between Obama and Romney, it was a very short mention by Romney of a North American economy. Not North America,
yeah.
I should say. There was
he actually said that several times. He said it more than once about North America. And I'm like, I did not miss that. Not America, but North America.
Yep. And
yeah, short mention of that on the debate this past Tuesday.
I used
Tuesday,
to think my buddies were a bunch of conspiracy theorists on this North American economic bloc. And today, and what's going on with our open borders and everything else, and I you know, I'm no longer thinking my conspiracy theory friends were crazy.
Well, I, you know, as you all know, I've got my own blog. talk radio show, and where I have interviewed several people. You know, I've interviewed G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from the Black Lagoon. I mean, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Same difference. I interviewed a guy who's a friend of mine, Jerome Corsi. And Jerome Corsi has written such books as The Abomination and The Late Great USA. And he's written many things about, you know, the North American Union in all of these, and very well researched. And in fact, the Constitution Party back in 2008, there's a few of us that were trying to draft him to be our presidential candidate, but he felt what he was doing was more important. And then he went, you know, to Kenya to demonstrate that Obama was born in Kenya, but the Kenyan authorities would not let him into the country, and they put him back on a plane and sent him back to London. And I think, fortunately, they didn't just make him simply disappear.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so for time, but basically the bottom line is what we're starting to hear about this whole North America. I mean, this probably all ties into things we've talked about before, the UN, Agenda 21, all this stuff. But we could get – I mean, that could be a whole long conversation, so let's not go down that rabbit hole.
Well, let me just say on this particular issue that, you know, you bring up a lot of different points. You bring it from the international. You take a look at the national, and then you take a look at what's happening on the local level. And, of course, it's from the, you know, the UN and stuff that they are trying to get into the local, because it's what the Marine Corps would call an envelopment strategy. They are attacking us from all sides. And if people don't wake up to the fact that we are being attacked from all sides, you know, when I was growing up and during the Cold War, my dad said to me many times, son, we will never lose our country by war. The communists said they will defeat us without ever firing a shot. And that has always stuck with me. And that's what we're seeing is the demise of our country without ever a round being fired to destroy our country.
Yeah, I believe we're closer to that than anybody wants to even think about. We could, like I say, we could do a whole show on that one. Let me roll into my, I think I have the next question. Hold on, I got to scroll down, sorry.
That you do. Constitution questions.
There we go. Okay, so basically, we've already gone over, and you mentioned it already, so we won't, you know, go over this again, but you talk about the 16th and the 17th Amendment and the Fed of 1913. How do we turn this around? And I guess that's a trick question, because I haven't listened to all of it yet, but I listened to your interview with D.V. Kidd, and she's working at the state level. Can you talk about that? Because she makes that note that the federal government wanted to do it, they would have done it during the Bush era for 6 years of total control, and they did nothing. And and so she's working at the state levels to get this change. Can you explain your perspective on that?
Sure. But let me back, give a little kind of a historical point here, is that a few years ago, we started hearing, especially when Obama first became president, and I remember, and it was just before that, when Bush was, you know, doing all the stimulus stuff, and I remember Rick Perry, from the governor of Texas, who at one point in time says, we are not taking a dime of that stimulus money. Well, we found that he had to recant that statement, and justifiably so, because the federal government was taking the money out of his state. He certainly had a responsibility to try to recoup as much of that money back as he could possibly do for his people. So, but it was right at that time that Montana had written a bill that said, if we in Montana manufacture a weapon and it's sold in Montana to a person from Montana, then the federal government has absolutely no business in what we do with these arms, because of the, you know, and of course they're trying to circumvent the Commerce Clause, you know, where the government has gotten into state I'd have no business trying to use that. But it was during an era, at that particular point, that many states tried to really exemplify and stand on states' rights, trying to say, look, this is our business, not the federal government. And it was during that time I was taking a look at things, and I'm like, can a state really be sovereign once again? And so I actually wrote a book called State Sovereignty, and I was somewhat focusing a little bit on the state of Illinois since I happen to reside here. But if people, some of this information, I'd like to encourage your listeners to go to my website at constitutionallycorrect.org and go to the downloads, and you'll see where it says Randy's Writings, and download that thing. It's free. You can do it. Download as much, print it out, disseminate it, what you want, because it deals with this issue from a state sovereignty issue about the 16th, the 17th Amendment, the Federal Reserve, and all of these things, because it's going to give you a lot more information I can provide in the next few minutes.
Okay, and two things I'm going to interject with. One is, yes, so we've done a couple of shows about state sovereignty, state's authority, and those can be found in the Bard's Logic Political Talks archives. And we're going to do more shows on that as well, probably more so after the election.
I think we need to have Randy on when we do some of them, too.
Yeah, definitely. He'd be more than welcome to come. And two, I have a Stephen in the chat, in one of the chats, mentioned and asked, have you ever read a book called The Naked Communist? And it says, he says, they listed out their agenda, and his comments that most of it has been accomplished. And thank you, Stephen, for putting that in the chat. What's your thoughts on that, if we can digress on that?
I'm familiar with who Steve Houston is. We've had a conversation on Facebook before, and I appreciate that question. I've not read that particular book, but here's what's real interesting, is the Communist Manifesto. If you take a look at the planks, there's 10 planks in the Communist Manifesto, and if you take a look at those planks, you will see that, as Stephen has stated, most of it's been accomplished, you know, getting involved with the education and stuff. But here's what's real interesting is that we talk about the UN, and this is solely for, I mean, another discussion we could talk about this, but Agenda 21. Basically, Agenda 21 is the Communist Manifesto on steroids. And it is being perpetrated by the UN. You can actually go to the UN.org, is it, or whatever it is, and you can actually go to start looking through Agenda 21. It's all out there for the reading. But it's a way of attacking the globally, but in particular the United States, through issues of environmentalism, through education, and through all these other things. But he's right. Most of it's already been accomplished. They said what they were going to do. And we've just got to start having eyes to see what's going on and start fighting back.
Beautiful.
Cool. Speaking real quick, Chris, I just want to mention, he mentioned something that drew up a flag. Is Agenda 21, we've talked about that on other episodes that I've done. This is before we really started getting into the election. It's on Thursdays, and I will get back to this on Thursdays after the election, is what I call on Bard's Logic as Green Thursdays, in which I cover environmental issues, because I consider myself a green conservatism or a conservative environmentalist, and yes, they do exist because I'm one of them. However, I disagree with the top-down approach to what's supposed to be environmental protection, which actually it's just the liberal using and abusing the environmental movement in order to propagandize and to manipulate for their redistribution of wealth agenda. So that's something I like to cover, after the election, more about that, because I believe in a bottoms-up approach towards environmentalism. But I'd like to move on to the next series of questions. And this one is discussing the Constitution Party's down-ballot candidates.
Robert, can I interrupt
you? Yes.
Before I do move on to that, just let me state real quickly, is because Chris mentioned D.B. Kidd. I interviewed D.B. And, where I was coming at with that, my discussion is I've been looking at it more from a national level. How do we attack these things, make people aware at a national level what's going on? The real interesting thing about DV Kid is that she brings this down to a state level and how states can act upon certain bills, and she's already got the material out there already written that you can present to your legislators to be able to start acting upon this and start really causing some consternation within the state, where the states can actually start taking back some of their sovereignty, and they're doing so by repealing basically at the state level the 17th Amendment by saying, you know what, we're going to start doing the election of our senators the way it's supposed to be done, where the senators actually represent the states. And then, you know, DV talks about the elimination of the 16th Amendment, which is one of the biggest things that trumped state sovereignty in the beginning. And I think it's one of the things that really one of the biggest things that destroyed one of the biggest checks and balances to an overburgeoning federal government. So I just wanted to say that real quickly, that there is a discussion, and they can check it out on my blog, Talk Radio, as well.
Right. And I actually have the post. I've been putting your post up to that interview, and I think it's really important, and I'd love to come back to this conversation in depth in another show if we can pull this off. You know, us three plus Kelly get together and really go after this, because this is fascinating stuff.
Right.
And it's so important.
I was just going to say, Kelly Mordecai is another member of the panel, and he's very knowledgeable on states' rights and the federal grand jury and things of that nature. And I'm sure he could tell you more of what he's done. He's also written a book called The Hidden Fourth Branch that I recommend for folks. But getting back to the question I was asking about the Constitution Party's down-ballot candidates and how they are doing across the nation. I believe I've got here that there are 107 candidates.
I'm willing to believe. I know we're somewhere close to that. And I certainly don't have a lock on, because a lot of these races are more local. But we do have some very significant races that are very important and very crucial. And in my opinion, one of the single most important races that we have going on in this country is with the race that is being run by a lady by the name of Cynthia Davis, and she's running for lieutenant governor in the state of Missouri. And what makes this so important is a couple of things. Number one, she was a former state representative in the state of Missouri. She was elected four times to the House. She was elected in some municipal races, and she had done all of this as a Republican. And the first of this year, she was actually received what was called the Locke and Smith Award for being the most constitutional legislator in the state of Missouri. Well, she is running for lieutenant governor as a Constitution Party candidate. She, in her own verbiage, she says, "I will no longer throwing my body on the funeral pyre of martyrs within the Republican Party. The pile is climbing sky high, and she wants to take effect in a state that, you know, in a position where she can actually have an effect." Now, here's the thing. She's actually got a significant and strong chance to win, and she strategically chose the lieutenant governor's race over the governor's race because of this particular fact. As a third-party candidate, as we're always hearing, "You're going to split the vote, you're going to split the vote, oh my God, you're going to make this person win or lose," or, you know, whatever. Well, you know, for the governor's race, that's all we would hear: "You're going to split the vote, you're going to split the vote." But she chose the lieutenant's governor's race because people be thinking, okay, I can't split the vote for the governor's race, but hey, you know, it's just the lieutenant governor, so we can split the vote there. And she's really been working hard. She knows how to campaign. Like I said, she was an elected representative, so she knows how to campaign. She's got billboards. She's really connecting. She's got endorsements from many organizations, such as the pro-life organizations there and all that. So I think that is, in my opinion, the single most important race that we have across the nation, because it is a statewide race. And if she wins, it's kind of like I said about Virgil Goode. If he won, no longer would they be able to say, well, a third party can't win. So that's a real important, and I think she's got an on. I'm telling you, I'm excited, and I think she is real. I'm not just blowing smoke here, and I'm not just trying to say this to excite people, although it is pretty exciting. I think she's going to win that race.
Cool.
We've got a guy running for that state house up in Michigan, and because of how things evolved there, it looks like he's got a pretty good chance of winning. Now, we've got a guy by the name of Dale Dortch running for state representative here down in Illinois. And interestingly, for whatever reason, the Republican Party or the Democrats did not contest his signature, so he's actually on the ballot. And what's interesting about this particular race is that the Republican did not get enough signatures to get on the ballot in the primary. And so at this point in time, when the primary, at the end of the conclusion, there was nobody but the Democrat who was running for office there. Well, once Dale Dortch got his signatures and got on the ballot, all of a sudden, out of the woodwork comes this Republican who now wants to get on the ballot. And so they, you know, do this whole, you know, filling the vacancy kind of a thing. And so now you've got a Republican on there. And, you know, it, in all appearances, it's, the Republican is there just to split the conservative vote, because Republicans will always vote Republicans kind of stuff. And but I think Dale's got a real good chance. We've got other candidates around the country that are running good races and are doing very well. And I think they're going to make a strong and significant impact. But I'm telling you, if we get Cynthia Davis to win, I think the dam is going to break and we're going to see a flood. Now all of a sudden people are like, hey, third parties can win.
Well, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, I know I've recently have spoken with Don Schrader, who I'm sure you know, the Ohio state chair here. And he was talking, we had a conversation, not a real long one, but it's still a good one. And, you know, working towards increasing the number of candidates to run here in Ohio, especially before 2014, to get some, you know, more local candidates and also sheriff positions as well. Yeah, right. Chris, I just wanted to chime in on that.
Yeah.
Well,
so just for time,
your next
sorry,
question, though, Robert, just, you know,
sure.
I want to move into this real quick because it's kind of associated with it. How important is it to win U.S. and Senate races? And here's where it's really important because, you know, for years I was told, look, if you're going to win a race, you know, you're okay, so what if you get in there? You're not going to have people who are going to support the bills that you sponsor. So, you know, you're always going to be outvoted, outnumbered, outgunned, and you'll never amount to anything because there's just nobody else there. Well, I had to kind of put up with that. I didn't really believe it's true, but I had no comeback until we actually got a state representative elected in Montana, a guy by the name of Rick Jor. Now, here's what happens. Rick Jor, because he's not a Republican and because he's not a Democrat, virtually became the most powerful man in that House. Because he wasn't a Democrat, the Republicans could come to him and ask him for support on their bill. Because he wasn't a Republican, the Democrats could come and ask him for support on the bill. And because he was nonpartisan, so to speak, he was actually appointed to three or four different chairmen. Three or four different committees, and I believe one of those committees was chairman of the Finance Committee. Imagine that, a constitutionalist who was a chairman of the Finance Committee because he was not a Republican or Democrat. And so I think people need to understand, rather than being marginalized and minimalized, as what frequently happens within the two-party structure, because we're not one of those two-party affiliates, we can literally become the most powerful feature in the House or in the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've talked about this before and interviewed the gentleman that's running for the U.S. House in Las Vegas and had this discussion. So here's, Randy, just because of time, I'm watching that clock really tight, and and we get into the area where is the one I really want to help the listeners understand, and that is the bigger picture, because I think that for people who are not as versed, you know, because you have raised yourself politically inside of a third party, so you really understand this. And for those of us who are doing the research to, you know, to get the information out to people, how important, and I know you and I have talked about this before and you briefly touched on it before, but how important is the Libertarian Party to this whole mix of success in defeating the duopoly? And the second thing I think is equally important is there's a lot of misconception about libertarians, because I know a lot of pro-life, strong border security libertarians, but there's a lot of people out there that think libertarians want open borders and are pro-choice and things like that. And I think there's some confusions here. And I'm also working on getting, Robert and I are working on getting some more actual candidates from the Libertarian Party, because until your party or the Constitution Party has candidates all over the country for us, we don't, you know, like here in Washington State, I can vote for Good. That's great. But I got no congressman to vote for. I have no senator to vote for. I have no state reps to vote for. So I have to look across that aisle and go, okay, who's the most constitutionally minded person? And that may very well be a libertarian. And I find that a lot of people don't understand that maybe people don't agree with the social issues, some of the social issues with libertarians. They don't understand that libertarians are pretty constitutionally minded, and at least they're not going to abuse the Constitution, and they may be a good choice. Can you kind of overview that in briefly?
Yeah, I certainly can. Not only libertarians, but I believe that the Green Party and, you know, any other party should be, you know, a part of this discussion. Now, certainly there are, you know, people within the Libertarian and within the Green Party that I could not support. And right now, as far as I know, there isn't one single person that I couldn't support within the Constitution Party. And if I ever find them, I'm taking them out. But the point is that I'm actually
real
a member
quick,
of the
Randy,
board of directors.
Hey, Randy, real quick. This is Robert. Real quick. I just wanted to say, because we sometimes it's unfortunate, but it's a fact of radio, as you probably well know, is there are times that we have trolls here on the shows, and just as a disclaimer to those folks so they don't misquote you, is when he means taking out, he means, I think, politically and not by violent means. I just want to say, no, I'm serious. I've had people say a few things where people said, oh, my gosh, they said they're going to kill somebody or this or that. I'm not joking. So that I mean, people could, you can use whatever terminology you'd like, you know, within reason, of course. But I just wanted to do that. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Fair enough.
That's that Marine talk.
Yeah,
I don't mind.
But, you know, the point is that you know, here's what happened in 2010. The Republican Party spent nearly $250,000 and kept me off the ballot. And, you know, we were going to take it to the Supreme Court, but we ended up, you know, with only 3 weeks left till the general election. You know, by the time we got it through the Supreme Court, the elections are done, and, you know, we're no better off. So at 3 weeks prior to the election, we just said, okay, the fight's over. And at that point in time, because the Libertarian candidate, a guy by the name of Michael Labneau at the time, running for the U.S. Senate, was pro-life, I personally endorsed him for his campaign and candidacy. And, you know, where we don't have a dog in the race, we're stretching across the aisle in many different areas. And when I say stretching across the aisle, we're talking about other, you know, primarily third-party candidates, but even we have, as a Constitution Party of Illinois, we've even supported at the local level a Republican candidate who was a candidate that we could support. They had to answer our questionnaire. They had to belly up to our principles. But once they did, then we were able to work with them to, you know, look, try to stem off the corruption as long as we can. So,
right.
You know, we've got to work together. We've got to build these bridges. It's Rich Whitney of the Green Party helped me here in Illinois. He ran for governor in 2006 when I did. He got ballot access. I didn't. But he invited me to his press conference to announce his gubernatorial race. And he said, Randy, I'm not letting you have my platform, but I'll let you have access to the media, and you can talk to them to your heart's content. And, you know, I learned something out of that. We need to work together because there is a two-party duopoly we have to destroy. And, you know, where we can work together, we must build these bridges. We must topple this empire if we are ever going to take our country back. And so I'm willing to work with Republicans at the local level because I believe that the, you know, upper stratosphere is totally controlled. It's totally corrupt, especially here in the state of Illinois. And, you know, libertarians, Green Party, whatever, to get this under control.
Well, and the reason I say this is as we have been vetting the candidates, so to speak, and learning about the parties, people have split off. You know, I'm all this and I'm all that, and I've been trying to keep this more broad spectrum mentality because, I mean, there's no doubt. I've interviewed a lot of Constitution Party people. You know, I mean, come on. I'm pretty darn conservative. But at the same time, you know, even though Johnson has taken some kind of what I would call left turns, I also know that those things that he said are not platformed on the Libertarian Party because I have Libertarian Party friends who are pro-life, strong Christians. And so there's some confusion out there, and there seems to be a large batch of people, you know, who just jumped, you know, that wall came up, and it was almost like I couldn't get the conversation back to a normal conversation about working together to defeat the duopoly. And that's I know you and I have talked about this before.
And part of the problem is because some people have their, you know, hardcore issues, and quite frankly, you know, being pro-choice was a matter of the libertarian platform. And so, you know, that's thus the confusion. Now they've eliminated that so that you can be pro-choice or pro-life in the Libertarian Party, and that's, you know, kind of, you know, to bring more of a big tent kind of a feel to it. The Constitution Party, however, will not eliminate our pro-life position. And but, you know, where we can work with people, and for me personally, you know, trying to vote for Gary Johnson is absolutely not a person I can vote for because of his moral positions, you know, being pro-choice and being pro, you know, allowing for gay marriages and some of the other stuff. I couldn't vote for him because it's a matter of principle. But can we work with the Libertarian Party to try to bust this two-party duopoly? Absolutely.
And you also, back to what we were saying before, just to not to rehash it, but there are down-ballot candidates in both parties who are pro-choice, I mean pro-life, and strong borders, and strong Christians. They just happen to be in the Libertarian Party.
Right,
now,
which is why I, you know, endorsed Michael Labneau, because he was a Libertarian, but he was pro-choice. He was pro-family. And so, you know, he had my full support because I could support those principles.
Here's the thing, you've heard Kelly on the radio shows because he's in the Libertarian Party, comes from the Paul background, strong Christian, strong pro-life guy. But Kelly, as a new in the Libertarian Party, we've had conversations about this, and he said, you don't realize these parties are small compared to the DNC and the RNC. You can actually affect platform changes, you know, and that's the thing, because you made a very important statement that the Libertarian Party was pro-life. Somebody changed that platform, which means it could be changed back. And my contention has always been is we need competition. And,
exactly.
And we've got to look out across this road and look who are, you know, in my first criteria is who is constitutionally minded. That's my first question. Then the other things fall below that because some of those other issues are platform issues. But if it's the Constitution first, I know that inside that party, I'm going to find constitutionally minded people. They may not, you know, I may find, like you said, you may find a guy, I ain't going to vote for him because I don't agree with him because he's way too left for me on these issues. But in that same party, I'm going to find a guy that's extremely conservative. And I think people get a little confused about that party because it has a broad spectrum of people in it. And you have more experience with them than I do. But can you elaborate on that?
I think you make the point, and, you know, that, you know, where we can work together, and this is, you know, I think this is crucial because what's happened, you know, that I've seen over the years is people have come across and tried to create this big tent party. Okay, we're going to create a platform that says we just believe in the Constitution. Well, you know, there's such a divergence of opinions and stuff like that. It's, you know, it's impossible for us really to kind of get some common ground here. So I'm not suggesting that we have a combination of some big tent party, because it's impossible, because, you know, we uphold some of our values and the tenets of our belief so strongly, and, you know, that's in all of these parties. And so we're not going to get people to just kind of join this big tent party just to destroy the duopoly. But what we need to do is be able to develop strategy amongst ourselves to support one another in where we can absolutely support one another, build these bridges so that we can topple this two-party duopoly. And, you know,
right.
Certainly, you know, there's some struggles to do that, but we've really got to start, you know, being able to cross some of these lines and be able to come to a point where, okay, we can agree on this. Let's roll and let's rock.
Right. So let me roll in the last few minutes, and we might have to have you call in tomorrow night and we can get more in depth into this stuff. But where you guys stand right now, you saw those last 4, 5, 6, 7 questions where I just had that line of questions in a row, you know, the strengths and weaknesses
right.
in the party. What changes does your party need to make to become a major party? You know, what are they guys doing to create a more welcome environment for the Ron Paul youth? You know, what about growth, money, you know, all those kinds of things. So can you just kind of overview that last thing, you know, from this point forward? Because you know what I'm saying? We've got a lot of people leaving the major parties and a lot of independents.
I do want to kind of focus in on for a second, though. You asked the question is what are we doing to welcome the Paul movement youth?
Right.
And one of the things that I'm doing, and I found a dynamic young man by the name of mm-hmm. Joshua Faber, and we are creating what's called the Young Constitutionalists. Now, in this particular effort, we are focusing on college campuses, and we are wanting to establish Young Constitutionalists in college campuses all across this nation. But one of the things that happened is we did this once before, but it kind of rested upon the shoulders of one guy who was a sophomore. 2 years later, he was gone and the organization fell. So what I want to do in that learning experience of seeing that is to create also a system of mentors to be able to come alongside these youth to guide them in principles of leadership, to guide them throughout this process, and so that if the one young person graduates, well, we're looking for somebody else to step up and fill the void, and we're using this as a teaching tool as well as a tool to capitalize on the youth. And so I'm really looking to see us marry up a system of mentors and young people, because look, we saw the phenomenal energy that the youth have, and we want to capitalize that, and we want to help them understand, look, you need to get involved because the decisions that are being made today are going to affect your future. And so really going to capitalize on that. Secondly, one of the secondarily probably most important things is the money issue. And we have really got to start tackling how to raise money. And because while money's not everything, it's certainly important to run campaigns, to pay for gas, to go to events and all of that. And so really trying to focus on how to raise money and to be more efficient at it and to become better. How can people get involved and help? Well, look, if we are ever going to take this country back, and we saw the Tea Party really started making a great effort when it first got started at the grassroots. But part of the problem was there was no strong organization that kept everything together and provided cohesion. It was this person doing their own thing, that person doing their own thing, and so on and so forth. So what we've got to do is people have got to get involved at the local level, and one of the most important local level positions of leadership that we need people to step up to is county organizer or county chairman or county coordinator, county POC, whatever you want to call it. We've got to get counties established throughout this state. And start running, you know, local candidates, both municipal and county. And that is probably where people can make the biggest effect in developing this party, is at that level. And, you know, all people got to do is contact me. I'll get them plugged into the state party and get them plugged into the right place. And, of course, you know, what are we doing to attract and develop candidates? Well, you know, one thing is the message. The message is probably the single, you know, for us as a, you know, Constitution Party, our message is one of the most important, you know, to uphold the Constitution. And so, you know, we're looking for people who believe this, that won't be captive to the two-party duopoly and won't be afraid to challenge the system. And, you know, to end with this, you know, you posted something by Thomas Paine that said, you know, in a paraphrase, you know, we do face a battle. You know, I was just thinking about this today. You know, I was thinking about, you know, Sparta and the Sparta 300s. You know, they were men who stood up regardless if they could win or not, because they knew what they were doing was the right thing to do. And we need people with that kind of courage and that kind of commitment to stand up and do what's right, regardless of, you know, the perspectives of winning or losing. And eventually, I believe we're going to win this. And I, you know, I'll tell you, when I joined the Marine Corps, the first thing I was taught was, I didn't join the Marine Corps to die for my country. I joined the Marine Corps to make that poor SOB die for his. And I plan to win this situation.
Okay, gentlemen, unfortunately we only have 5 minutes left.
We covered it. We did it.
Okay, great. Well, and then I want to have one caller, or not one, but I got many callers, but since we only don't have time.
On the call back tomorrow, we'll bring Randy back on, Robert.
Yes, definitely. We only got about 4 minutes left, and if Randy could come on tomorrow, of course, you'll have to answer that, whether you'd be able to now, because I'm sure you have scheduling you have to check with, but you can let myself or Chris know, and then, of course, we'd be more than happy to bring you on, you know, tomorrow as well, if that's something that's feasible for you. But I'd like to thank everyone, and hopefully I'll be able to let this caller in just for 1 minute, and it has to be a very quick question. But let's see if I can get this out first. I'd like to thank you, Randy, for coming into the show tonight. We definitely, as we've just noted, would like to have you on again. I'd like to thank everyone in the chat for their participation and all the questions that were asked tonight. We've got to cover a couple of them. If you missed them, just go ahead and go into the archives. And speaking of that, for all the folks who are going to be listening to this on recording in the archives, thank you very much as well for coming in and listening to the show. And, of course, thank you, Chris. So there's only about 3 minutes left. So if I you know, as I like to try to get callers in, if this person can have one quick question, if they think it could be answered very shortly, go ahead. If not, we can, as Chris noted, hopefully do it either tomorrow night or some other time. 347, your mic is live. We got one. Make it quick.
Good evening. I was in the chat earlier, and I had to get off, but my question was one about foreign policy, actually, because the Constitution Party says to withdraw all foreign aid completely, and yet, considering how President Obama has embedded us in
oh, Britain, yes. He did answer that. That is in the archives.
I didn't see it.
I did ask that question because I believe I recall seeing your question in the chat, and that is the one that I did specifically ask Randy to answer, and he did. And as I said, you can find them in the archive, or perhaps that question answered again if he's able to come in again tomorrow night.
Yeah, Robert, he said yes, he can come in tomorrow, and we can open this up and have a full-on just conversation now that we've had a controlled environment. So we can have fun tomorrow. So, Robert,
right,
that's the other Robert from New York. So let's do this tomorrow, buddy. We're running out of time.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And at this time, I'm going to close out the mics, because I'd like to begin playing the closing song, which I do every night. by Aubrey Ashburn. It's a great way to just kind of bring us down from the excitement of the evening. And everyone take care. Have a good night. And hope to see you again tomorrow.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you. Good night.
Spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.